This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There we have, after that beautiful meeting of Yaakov and Rachel, we have Yaakov bursting into tears. In chapter 29, verse 11, Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel, and Yaakov kissed Rachel, Vayisa et kolo vayefk, and he raised his voice and he wept. What did he cry about? Rashi brings two interesting views. The first one is vayefk, l'fi shetrafa beruach hakodesh she'eino nichnes l'simo l'kvura, because he was able to see with his ruach hakodesh, with his prophetic vision, that they weren't going to be buried together. And that bothered him, that there was going to be an ending point to their togetherness. Davar Acher, another reason, l'fi shebabi adayim rekaniyot, that he had no gift to give her. He was overwhelmed with the desire to do something with her, to give her something, and he couldn't. Omar, and he said to himself, Eliezer eved avi, Eliezer was only the slave of my father. Hayu biyodov nezomim utzmidim umigdonos, when he went to the well and he met Rivka on behalf of Yitzchak, he had jewelry and he had all sorts of exotic gifts. Vani en biyadi klum, and I've come and I've got absolutely nothing to give her. Why did he have nothing? Not because he was poor or he came from a poor family, he came from a very wealthy family. But l'fi sheradaf Eliphaz ben Esav b'mitzvach oviv acharov, when Yaakov left home, Esav instructed his son Eliphaz to pursue him and to kill him. And he caught up with Yaakov. So now Eliphaz has come, and his father is instructed to kill the wicked brother of his, Yaakov. Ulefi shegadal Eliphaz b'cheko shel Yitzchak, but Eliphaz was raised by his grandfather, by Yitzchak. Eliphaz was not raised by Esav. Esav was busy doing his thing. So Eliphaz was raised with a very good value system. Moshach Yodah, he caught up with Yaakov, and he saw Yaakov, and he saw what kind of a man he was, and there was no way he was going to kill him. Amale, he said to Yaakov, I've got a shaila, I've got to ask you a question. My esev l'tzivui shel ava, I've been instructed by my father to kill you. I've got an obligation to respect my father, but I'm not going to kill you. There's no way I'm going to kill you, but what do I do? Amale Yaakov said to him, that would have been very easy. What do you think anybody else in the world would have said? Yeah, your father tells you to murder. What do you need to ask me a shaila whether you have to listen to your father? Of course you don't have to listen to your father. You don't have to listen to a father if a father tells you to do something that's wrong and that's immoral. Yaakov doesn't say that. Yaakov says you have to obey your father. You have to kill me. Did you know that Yaakov said that? You have to kill me. Tol ma shebeyodi veheoni choshev kemes. Take all my possessions, and then I will be as if dead. So the Gemara says a poor person is like a dead person. If one has no assets, if one has no money, then one is impotent in the world. One cannot do anything in the world. And that's a very important phrase. And of course, that does not mean that money is everything. It means having no money is nothing. And the two are not parallel. And that's where people get themselves into a philosophic mess. They say, since money isn't everything, then surely there's nothing wrong with being poor. The answer is no. Money is not everything. But poverty is nothing. It's not enough to have money. But if you haven't got money, you've got nothing. And money is very, very important. That's not intended to make a poor person feel inadequate. But it is important for our young people to know, and not so young people to know, that money is important, and they must stop with this nonsense that money isn't important. I'm quite happy to live in Israel in some kolo, and my parents and parents-in-law will support me because money isn't important. It isn't so. Money is important. One cannot achieve anything without money. One cannot do chesed, one cannot do tzedakah, one cannot build, one cannot invest, one cannot grow. Money is a very spiritual concept. Money is not a material concept. What you do with money can be material. What money does to you can be material. But money in itself is the capacity of the human being to generate value. And that's not material, that's spiritual. And the absence of that, not having money or access to money or the ability to generate money, is something very serious. And the Gemara said, if you don't have it, you're like dead. You're not a living person. And therefore, Yaakov says to Eliphaz, take my money. And you can then go back to your father and you can say, I killed him, because in effect you did. Halachically you killed me, conceptually you've killed me, you've deprived me of my life by taking my money. Now why didn't Yaakov give him the obvious answer? Why didn't Yaakov say you don't have to listen to your father? That's a very nice answer, but listening to a parent who tells you to do something wrong is not honoring that parent. You honor the parent by not listening to them. And we have that, for example, when a parent leaves in a will that they want to be cremated. And the children say, no, I'm going to honor my parents. My parents will. I'm going to honor them. It's no honor to do that. Because where your father is now, or your mother, he now is saying to himself, oh my goodness, I just hope to goodness that they don't listen to me. That they understand that I wrote that out of ignorance. And then the child goes on and says, I've honored my parents' will, you know, and they go and throw the parents into the furnace. It isn't so. Doing when you know for sure that what the parent has asked you to do is not correct, there's no mitzvah of honoring a parent to carry that out. So there was no mitzvah here. Why didn't he simply say to him, he says, you are not obligated to do that. You're not obligated to do that. Yeah.
Well, he would have had to go back and either lie or get killed, probably, by his father.
It's a lie. That's the only way to save your life. Go back and say, I killed him. Would be one possibility. Mrs. Kahn? Oh, that's not really what he's saying. You're right. He gives something to Eliphaz and that bonds the relationship between them. But I think the reason is very simply that in this case, Esav is entitled to kill Yaakov. There's nothing wrong with Esav killing Yaakov. Yaakov is threatening the very existence of Esav. Yaakov is threatening the spiritual future of Esav. There's nothing wrong. That doesn't mean that Yaakov is guilty of death in a court of law. But certainly for somebody who's being threatened to the extent that Yaakov was threatening Esav, it's not unreasonable for Esav to want to kill him. So for Yaakov to say to Eliphaz, Esav is telling you to do something wrong. No, from Esav's perspective, he's telling you the right thing. I'm in his way. If I succeed, he fails. Wasn't that the prophecy? So in order to protect Esav knows, just as Rivka knew, that in order to get that for Yaakov to survive, Esav needs to be deprived of the brachas. So Yaakov knows that for Esav to survive in any kind of meaningful way, he's got to eliminate Yaakov. So there's nothing inherently wrong with that battle. There's nothing inherently wrong with the desire of Esav to destroy Yaakov from Esav's perspective, because only one is going to win at the end of it. And if one looks at that, if one wants to see anti-Semitism, Western anti-Semitism as a projection of Esav, and that's the only thing that explains it, because nobody else has been able to explain anti-Semitism. Historians have grappled with it, sociologists have grappled with it. Nobody has been able to explain the scale and the continuity and the virulence of anti-Semitism. It just doesn't make sense. Why? Why this hatred? But if it's all an extension of Esav, then yes, the Western civilization in its pure form, in its completely secular form, is bothered in its very existence by the existence of a Jewish value system. And Esav understands that, and Esav sees that. So from Yaakov's perspective, he's not going to say to Eliphaz, what Esav has told you to do is unreasonable. It is not unreasonable. For him, it is reasonable. But if you take my money, you'll be able to tell him that you did me in. But meanwhile, I've got nothing to give to... I didn't predict this, I didn't foresee this, but I'm going to come to a situation. And isn't that interesting? He doesn't cry because he can't afford a Cadillac. He doesn't cry because he can't buy a house. He doesn't cry because he's going to have to work for Lavan for years and years to be able to reestablish himself. That's not what he's crying about. I can't give a gift. If I had money with me, I could give a gift. And that pains him. The inability to give a gift pains him enormously. And here we see these two people, Eliphaz and Yaakov. What should Eliphaz have done with the money? He should have taken the money and said, okay, now I've killed you. Now I would like to give you a gift. And give him back the money. How did Eliphaz take the money? But maybe he needed it in order to be able to placate Esav further on. But you see, there's two different approaches to money. Esav and Eliphaz, who are gatherers of money, and Yaakov, who is a giver of money. and wants money so that he can give, wants money so that he can invest, wants money so that he can be generous. And the incapacity to be generous pains him. And that's what determines whether money is material or physical. When a person wants money and feels the pain of not having money because of what he doesn't have, that's material money. When he feels the pain of not having money because of what he cannot give, that's spiritual money. Tikkun gives a slightly different interpretation into the crying and says, Al Shaloi Zocho Lasei So Bin Urov. He burst into tears at the thought of the wasted years, that he could have married her years ago, he only met her earlier. And the thought that he was already in his 80s, 70s at this point, when he met her, that caused him a great deal of sadness. At the Medrash that I mentioned to you at the end of last week, is another reason which we're going to discuss today. And it says the following. Lama Bacha, why did he cry? Shira'aha Nashim Melachashim Eilu Le'ilu. He saw the shepherds whispering to one another, gossiping. Mibnation Ashoko, because he kissed her. And they were saying, Mo Bazel Chadesh Lanu Dvar Erva. We managed to get rid of this kind of behavior. After the flood, we rid our society of improper relationships between men and women. And here comes a stranger, and he's just met this girl, and he's kissing her already. It's just not okay. This is not something that's just in our society is acceptable. Because from the time of the flood, the nations of the world got together and analyzed what had gone wrong, and they figured that's the area that had gone wrong, that's why God had got angry, and they made certain rules about the way men and women behave with one another. Amrit, that's where people get it from, that Anshe Mizrach Gezurim in Erev, as we discussed last week, people east of Israel are careful about modesty and the way that men and women conduct themselves together. And he cried because of those whisperings, which leads us into a question of how important is it what some coarse group of non-Jewish shepherds have to say about you. He knows he didn't do anything wrong. He knows she's her relative, she's his relative, he knows exactly what he's doing. And he's not crying because he did something wrong. It doesn't say he's crying because, oh, he suddenly realized that in a moment of passion he did something he shouldn't have done. It's not saying that. It's not saying he's crying out of repentance. So he's quite satisfied that he's done nothing wrong. Yet he notices that in the eyes of the shepherds, in terms of their society, he has offended them. And they're whispering. And he cries as a result of that. Why the cry? We have two other cases of where tears are brought about by the fact that people are wrongly suspected. The one was Yosef. And when after Yaakov dies, and Yosef, they're all reunited in Egypt, the brothers fear that with Yaakov dead, Yosef will take it out on the brothers. They can't understand how he hasn't done so yet. Look what they did to him. Look what kind of a life Yosef had because of what the brothers did to him. So the brothers must have lived every moment wondering when Yosef was going to take revenge. Finally, Yaakov dies, and they figure out now's the time. As long as our father was alive, he wouldn't have done that, but now's the time. So they say to Yosef, our father instructed before he died that there should be peace in the family. Yosef knows it's not true. Doesn't bother him, he wasn't planning for it to be anything else. But the Medrash says he cried at the thought of being suspected of revenge. That the brother should even have thought him capable of it caused him tears, caused him to cry. And the third place that we find it is on Yom Kippur. When towards the end of the period of the Second Temple, the position of high priest was one that was bought with money and sometimes in political power. So during those last decades of the Second Temple, the high priest was not a particularly holy man. The Kohen Gadol was a political appointment. The Romans appointed him, and he was a Kohen always, but he certainly wasn't any kind of a tzaddik. And they used to die, because if one goes into the Holy of Holies, if one goes into the Kodesh Kodashim, and one isn't the right kind of person, you didn't come out. And each year there was a new Kohen Gadol. Every Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol died. And each time a new one came and was sure that he would be able to fool God and survive. And each year after year, This is all historically recorded. But what they used to have to do was the clerks of the temple of the Beit HaMikdash used to prepare the Kohen Gadol. This was a very complicated temple service on Yom Kippur, and the complexity was first in what he had to do. He had to be very agile, he had to be very quick, well coordinated, so there was a lot of physical preparation that had to take place, but also a lot of mental preparation. There was enormous concentration, and one could damage a sacrifice not only by doing it incorrectly, but by thinking something incorrect. Now, the doing it correctly, they could watch him, and they could check that he was doing it right and correct anything that went wrong. But what do you do about a man's thoughts? So you've got to have complete trust in the Kohen Gadol that he's going to be thinking the right things while he's doing the sacrifices, because he's doing it for the whole nation. This is really important stuff. So they take him and they make him make an oath, because oaths were things that they were very careful about. People are still careful about it, but in those days even more so. That even somebody who kept nothing else, an oath was something very, very serious. And they used to make him take an oath that he wouldn't reform any of the temple service, not in action and not in thought. Because at that time there were the two groups already. There were the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the Sadducees and the Purushim. There was already a reform movement. Christianity, in fact, was a stem from that reformation, the reformation of the Sadducees. The Sadducees, that group of people, used to try and get hold of the high priest and persuade him to do it their way. So the Perushim used to get hold of people who controlled the temple, used to get hold of the high priest just before Yom Kippur and make him swear that he wouldn't deviate from what they taught him. And it says, in the Mishnah it brings, that they used, and this was done already quite early days, they used to cry and he used to cry. They used to cry that it was necessary to make him swear that they were dealing with something so unsatisfactory, and he used to cry that they used to suspect him of doing that, because sometimes the Kohen, even if he wasn't the greatest high priest, but he certainly wasn't going to do anything wrong, yet the thought that they had to take him and make him take that oath caused him to cry at being suspected. So we have three cases of people crying, being brought to tears for being suspected of something they weren't doing or had no intention of doing. Why is that so important? Our tendency today is to say, who cares what people think? I know what I'm doing, and that's the end of it. Let people mind their own business. And yet we see it isn't quite so. And I want to learn with you two pieces on this. The one is the Maharal of Prague, who has a very fascinating essay on the topic, or partially on the topic. The Maharal of Prague noted, you know, he was this, in Prague till this day, you can stop a non-Jew in the street. If he's of a family that has lived in Prague for generations, ask him about the Maharal. And he will have stories about the Maharal. He was a man that commanded such stature in Jewish and non-Jewish circles, in the royal court. There's still a statue that they built of him in Prague today, that the city put up of the Maharal. And there are all these wonderful stories about him. He was the person who created the golem. He wasn't the only one, but he was the famous one. The golem was a robot. He created a being that could act. When his committee didn't treat him well, he used to send his golem to go and bash them up. And the golem was created. He was created of clay, and he could use Kabbalistic methods to enable this golem to function. He could instruct the golem to do things. The golem couldn't think, but he could obey. And the Maharal was the creator of this most amazing man. And he says the opposite of the concept of having a good name is being a Baal Shem Ra. Baal Shem Ra means owning a bad name. Kemoshe Baal Shem Tov Noedam Ala Toha Elyona. Just as a Baal Shem Tov, there's a concept of a Baal Shem Tov, somebody who owns a good name. A good name is an asset. And he talks about the value of a good name and why it's an asset. And so also there's such a thing as a Baal Shem Ra. You own a bad name, and that's something bad. Why? Because mechalel atzmo uchvodo. With a bad name, a person is mechalel himself and his honor. What does mechalel mean? Mechalel isn't really a good. Chilul Hashem, he debases, probably is the best word. He debases himself and his dignity. And self-honor and self-dignity is something that in the modern world we're losing sight of. In our attempt to say it doesn't matter what people think, I can dress the way I want to dress, and I can chew gum in public, and I can It just doesn't make any difference. I'm not here on show, and I don't care what people think. I'll do what's comfortable for me. That attitude results in a complete loss of dignity, because dignity is dependent to a large degree, not entirely, but to a large degree, on the way one is perceived, on the image that one creates. Not that one should live for one's image, but you can have something of great value that isn't projected properly, it loses value in the process. And we've often talked about that, the importance of packaging, the importance of presentation. If you went to buy a diamond, and the jeweler showed it to you, and you want a diamond, yeah, a diamond, you know, and pulled out of his pocket, he pulled out some matches and some cigarette stubs, and he says, yeah, here's a diamond, there's one, I've got another one somewhere, here's another one, and you say, well, how much are these? He says, well, that's $200,000, and that's $50,000, and that's, you know, you're not going to do it. But if he says, a diamond, you want a diamond, not in this room, come, this is a special room, that's where I show my diamonds. And he calls for somebody to bring this lady a glass of champagne. We're going to be looking at some diamonds. And he opens his safe and he takes out these beautiful boxes and he brings a special light. And he shows you a diamond that's not nearly worth the one he showed you when he took it out of his pocket. And he quotes you a price twice as high. Are you going to look at it if you have the money? Yes, you would. The value, we can debase things by the way we present them. No matter how valuable they are, you can take the most valuable thing in the world and you can debase it. Now, you can also take a cubic zirconium and you can present it like a diamond and you can fake. So when we come to presentation, we're not talking about presenting something that is not true. That's not called presentation. We're simply talking about doing justice when you present. Present something for what it really is. And there's nothing so precious and valuable as a human being. Why present him in a way that is so disgusting? Why present him in a way that is so cheap? If there's nothing, if we're willing to dress up all sorts of valuable things, why are we not willing to dress up human beings? And dressing up doesn't just mean in clothing, it means in behavior, it means in bearing, it means in context, it means in everything that goes to the presentation of who that human being is. Now, I've told you before, I think, that one of the tourist attractions in the city of Kovno used to be the Kovno Rav's daily walk. And non-Jews used to come to Kovno and line the streets like they used to in England when the Queen went out. They don't do it anymore. But they used to, if you heard that the Queen was going out, you couldn't get anywhere near the place just to watch her drive past. What do you see when she drives past? You just see a bit of honor. But the Kovno Rav, you could actually see, you went for a walk. But apparently the sight was so magnificent. It was to demonstrate human dignity, to demonstrate what a human being should look like. People used to come from all over the world to be at whatever time it was. He was a very meticulous person about time, so you could set your watch by the time he left his house and apparently walked down the main avenue of Kovno, tree-lined avenue, and he used to go for his walk and back, and literally the streets were lined because of the dignity of the human being. And part of that dignity is the reputation. Again, if I'm going to take you out to buy a diamond, and I take you to, you say, well, where are we going? I say, well, you've never heard of it before. It's actually a tailor, but he deals in diamonds on the side as well. I take you to the tailor and he brings out the diamonds. Or I say, you know where we're going? We're going to Cartier. That's where we're going. Now, the tailor might have a better diamond than Cartier, but you would rather go to Cartier. There's a reputation, there's a shame, it's part of the presentation. Now, it's taken Cartier years and years and years to build that name, but that name is incredibly valuable. That name is valuable financially. That name is valuable. That name is valuable emotionally. Is it deserving or isn't it deserving? It must be deserving in some way or another. Does it mean necessarily that the diamond you'll buy from them is the best? No, it doesn't mean that. And yet, most women who are offered the chance would rather buy a diamond at Cartier than at the tailor. Why? There's reputation that comes with it. So with human dignity comes shame tov. And damaging that good name is damaging that reputation and that dignity. The zehu ha-pchitus ha-godol, and this is big, big degeneracy. That's a big loss. To lose a name, to lose a reputation is a big loss. The afilu im hu sheker, even if it's unjustified. When you're dealing with name, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It matters in the sense that if you've got an undeserved good name, then it's fake. But to have an undeservedly bad name, you cannot say it doesn't matter because it's not true. It's gone. It's finished. שבשביל כך יצירו חכמים שלא יביא האדם עצמו לידי חשדו. And that is the reason for a prohibition in the Torah called chashad. Chashad is different, and people get very, very confused about the concept. Maris Ayin is one concept, and chashad is a completely different concept. Maris Ayin is, you may not do something which cannot but look wrong. Okay? So, an example of Maris Ayin is taking a kosher hamburger that looks exactly the way McDonald's does it, and taking it in your lunch bag, and sitting at McDonald's and opening it up and eating it. So if somebody walked past and saw you, you're eating a hamburger, it looks exactly the same as McDonald's, and you're sitting in McDonald's, must be eating trash. That's my advice. And you can't do that even if nobody's there. Even if you're on a desert island, you can't do that. You can't. Maris Ayin is not what will people say if they see. Maris Ayin is something else. Maris Ayin is something which cannot but look wrong. You cannot do even if nobody sees it, because it is wrong. Maris Ayin is not having a Coca-Cola in the McDonald's. That's not Maris Ayin, because that doesn't look wrong. Anybody who sees you having a Coca-Cola in the McDonald's, what will they say? Oi, he's having a Coca-Cola. Fine, that's what I'm saying. That's not Maris Ayin. And if the people say, and I wonder what else he's having, that's not Maris Ayin. Maris Ayin is when what you're doing cannot but be interpreted wrong. So, eating would be the case with eating a kosher airline meal that is prepared to be identical to the other meals. Some airlines do that. They ask the kosher kitchen to prepare it identical, certainly in first class. It should look exactly the same as the other one. That would be Maris Ayin. That's a problem. When Mocha Mix first came out, there was a halakhic requirement that you had to have the box on the table until it became something accepted. Those are all Maris Ayin, because before people realized that there was such a thing as paralimilk, you're having a meat meal, coffee, and milk in the coffee, cream in the coffee. There's just no question. It's wrong. So those kind of things you couldn't do, even if there was nobody around. If you were having a cup of coffee with Mocha Mix alone at home, you had to leave the box on the table. That's what Maris Ayin is. But Maris Ayin, it's not very often that we come into the area of Maris Ayin. It's quite hard to do a Maris Ayin thing. You need quite a lot of artistry to do it so exactly that it cannot but look wrong. Now, if somebody wants to, because of his ignorance, doesn't understand, so you go into a trade for a restaurant, a businessman goes into a non-kosher restaurant, and he has a piece of smoked salmon and a light salad or something like that, leaving aside problems with bugs and things like that. Is that Maris Ayin? No, not Maris Ayin at all. If somebody sees him going into the trade restaurant, is that Maris Ayin? No, there's nothing wrong. Maris Ayin is only when you're doing an action where the action cannot but be seen to be wrong. There's nothing. There's no action that's wrong in walking into a trade restaurant. There's nothing wrong in walking in up to use the telephone. There's nothing wrong in sitting down at the table. There's nothing wrong in having a Coca-Cola or a smoked salmon. What about chashad? Chashad is a different problem. Chashad is people start talking. Now you have a problem. And people start talking in a way that damages your reputation. That's a different issue. That's got nothing to do with Maris Ayin. It's a completely different issue. People that halacha goes quite far in advising people to avoid it. It goes so far that in fact the Gemara says one shouldn't talk to one's wife in public, because somebody might see you who doesn't know that she's your wife. In those societies, obviously today that doesn't apply. So chashad is very much, if one's going to take chashad literally as it stands in the Gemara, that husbands and wives shouldn't be seen together in public. And they shouldn't talk together in public because somebody might see it and not know that she's your wife, etc., etc. But today that isn't the case, because men and women do go to public and husbands and wives do so it doesn't cause chashad. So in chashad you've got to look at each situation. What is the society? What's the norm? What are people saying? What would people say? Why would people say it? And so on. Ki afal pi shehu sheker, even though it's a lie, mikol makom yesh lo etzel acherim shem ra, but the fact is he's still got a bad name. So the bad name has got nothing to do with whether it's deserved or not. The bad name is something one wants to avoid, and unfortunately society gives people bad names, and sometimes due to nothing that you've done yourself other than keeping away from any possibility of getting a bad name. And part of the reason is because then people say, and it's very difficult to recover, because then people say, yeah, okay, maybe he didn't do that, but you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, something, it sticks. Something sticks, and it's difficult to get rid of it afterwards. Now, the Shalah is the other piece that I want to learn with you. The Shalah was a person who achieved notoriety both as a Kabbalist and as a Halachist. And he questions, so why doesn't the Torah leave it to us to just warn us and say, look, Shashad, the dangerous thing, look after your name and do whatever you want to. Why does the Torah actually guide us quite heavily in this area? What is wrong with it? If the person says, look, I don't care about my name, I really don't care, is that all right? Is the person entitled to say, I know that I'm doing is right? If silly people want to cause silly gossip, that's their problem, it's not my problem. Is there anything wrong with that? And the Shlach says there is something wrong with that. Why? He says, Matzina b'talmud habed varim she'osru mipnei hachshad. There are things that the halacha actually says, don't do this, you may not do this, because it causes chashad. For example, one is on Hanukkah, where those people who put their Hanukkah lights outside the door. If you have a corner house with an entrance on both streets, then although halachically you only have to put a menorah at one entrance, you're advised to put them at both entrances, because somebody might walk past your one entrance and say, oh, he doesn't like Hanukkah. So what would we say? Who cares? I do like it. I don't care what he thinks, whether I like the Hanukkah lights or not. But there's an awareness of it in the halacha which is out of proportion. Why? He says there are two reasons. Echad kadesh yisrael b'kvod shemayim. The one is for God. She'im adam nechshad b'dvar avera. Because if a person is suspected of having done something wrong, then God's dignity is damaged too. Because people say, this person is ignoring the law, this person is ignoring the halacha, he did such and such, it weakens the halacha. That's a such person. He doesn't do it. It can't be that important. So it weakens the value of God's will. Even if the person did do it, so indirectly what one has caused is for another person to have a weaker relationship with God's will, because that person thinks that you did this thing wrong or you didn't do this thing right. The time Hasheni, and the second reason is beautiful reason. Because God likes people to love each other. And if you hate somebody, that is prohibition. You're not allowed to hate people. And loving people is one of the fundamental mitzvah. The whole Torah, says the Shulah, rests on that. An amazing concept. The entire Torah rests on human relations and people being able to like each other and love each other. The imu soveh shorasa avera musa l'sanoseh. But if you believe that somebody is a wrongdoer, that somebody is an immoral person, you may despise his actions. And that, of course, brings you to distancing yourself from the person. That's the only basis. You can't not like a person just because you don't like him. He's a good, moral, upright person. Then one shouldn't act in a way that is hateful, but one can distance oneself from people who you hold to be wrongdoers, people who are immoral, people who are doing improper things. And therefore, if I do something which causes you to think that I'm a bad person, thereby causing you to dislike me for no real reason, because I didn't do it wrong, I have actually caused you to transgress one of the important laws of the Torah. I have a part of that responsibility. And as we've discussed this responsibility before, the fact that I have responsibility doesn't mean that you don't have responsibility. Of course you do. The fact that the person who didn't do wrong and is being wrongfully suspected is causing that suspicion by his actions, even though those actions went wrong, doesn't mean that the suspectors and the gossipers aren't doing wrong. Of course they're doing wrong. There's another whole section which we don't have time to give, how God punishes severely people who gossip and suspect people of wrong things and talk about it. God is very, very, very harsh on that. But that doesn't mean that one shouldn't also take steps to try and avoid that happening. So two reasons the Shulah gives. The one is it weakens God's, people's perception of God. The second is it weakens people's perception of oneself. And that causes a diminishment of relationship, and relationship is what's really important. And that will depend on the society. In a society where it doesn't diminish the relationship, so if a person is suspected of not keeping the Shabbos in a place where nobody keeps Shabbos, it's not going to make anybody hate him. So that reason for Chashad would fall away in that circumstance. The other reason might be that, look, even he doesn't keep Shabbos. So it can't be that important. That reason for Chashad will still remain in place. So Shulah gives those two reasons, and the And the Maharal focuses really on a third aspect of it, and it's the Maharal which is probably the most interesting for us to understand, is the loss of reputation. That reputation is part of the way a person projects himself. Now, that places enormous pressures on a person, and one has to be able to sort them out, because that means society can now start dictating what I do and what I don't do, and it's no longer dictated necessarily by what's right and what's wrong. When do I take account of that, and when do I not? What happens if society values things that are wrong, and is that important to me? And all of those things start coming up. It was us getting into the complexity of that, merely saying, in the areas of right and wrong, where society has a good value system, and I could lose my reputation, not for having done anything wrong, but for having been perceived to have done something wrong. The loss of shame tov is something that is of value, because shame tov, having a good name, is part of the way a human being presents himself. The reputation that he develops over years and years is part of the way he presents himself, and that's a very important part of his interrelationship. Stressing again that we're not saying a person, that there is any value in presenting oneself as more than one is. We're not talking about that at all. We're simply saying, don't allow the world to see you as less than you are, because that damages you. At least the world should see you for what you are. And part of our de-emphasizing self-dignity and self-honor, I think part of it is because people don't value themselves properly. We're just living in a society where there is such devaluation of the human being that we ourselves don't value ourselves that way. And so we present ourselves sometimes in a way that isn't okay. And sometimes it's because we've taken the view that we don't care about reputation. But the fact is, in business, we do care about reputation. Business people will pay a lot of money for reputation. People will buy a brand, building a brand. What's it all about? It's reputation. So in business, we do understand that society functions with reputation as one of the elements of the way it judges and the way it responds. And there's no reason why that shouldn't be in personal lifestyle as well. And so reputation is important not only in the areas of the Bein Adam, the Makom, and the man-god issues, where one shouldn't be suspected of doing something wrong, but even more so when it comes to the interpersonal relationships. That not only should one ensure that one's interpersonal relationships are fine, but also take steps to see that nobody should think that they're not fine. That there's a certain reputation when it comes to integrity, that there's a reputation when it comes to generosity, that there's a reputation when it comes to generosity of spirit, of the way we look at people. And people make certain assumptions, and they relate to you based on how they see you, based on first impression and what they've heard. And there's an enormous advantage to being related to as somebody who has a reputation for honesty, for integrity, for all these other things. And if one is that, why not have the reputation for it? And to value that reputation. What's also important in this whole process is, if reputation is so important, then what happens when people damage other people's reputation? How does God look at that? If reputation is such a valuable asset that takes so long to build, and that it's so hard to build, and it can so easily be fractured, how does God view the people who, word of Lashon Hara, cynical comments, an expression on their face when you just mention the other person's name, anything that can just damage, that can crack a person's reputation, that God has absolutely no tolerance for. And Chazal come down over and over again on the seriousness of HaChoshed B'Ksherim, how serious it is if one suspects somebody who is kosher, if one suspects somebody who is right of doing something that is wrong. That's a terrible transgression, and God has no tolerance for it. Nevertheless, Yaakov feels the pain of being suspected, that the threat is going into a new country. Nobody knows him. Nobody knows that he's the son of Yitzhak, the grandson of Avraham. Nobody knows who this man is. He comes with no money. And the first interaction he's got with the local society is, there's going to be a story in the newspaper tomorrow about the stranger who's come and is damaging the moral standards of our society. And he actually thinks, oi, all these three generations of building a family reputation, I've just blown. Not because I did anything wrong, but because I didn't understand the cultures here and things, and they're busy gossiping. That's causing me pain. And his sensitivity to that pain is something quite remarkable.